Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Ad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast. Hey Griefsters, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your continued amazing support of the new series. It is so appreciated. I wasn't sure if recording a series in lockdown was a good idea, but I'm really glad we did it. I think it's always a good time to talk about death, but particularly at the moment. If you have been enjoying the show, please do rate, review and subscribe. If you've done it already, thank you so much. But it really makes a difference to help other people find the show, so thank you so much. That is much appreciated. We have a live show coming up. Yes, a live show, the London Podcast Festival, 21st of September at King's Place. I will be talking to Sarah Pascoe, Athena Kablenu and Darren Harriott about death and such things. Now, obviously, you can come and see it socially distanced, but we are also streaming online, so you can watch it online from wherever you are. Head to the King's Place website, kingsplace.co.uk, for more information. This week, I'm talking to social entrepreneur and writer Lee Lawrence. Lee is the son of Cherry Gross, and as you'll hear in the interview, you might recognise that name. Cherry was wrongly shot by police during a raid in her Brixton home in 1985. She actually passed away many years later, and Lee has just written a book called The Louder I Will Sing that is out on the 17th of September. I, as ever, can't recommend it enough. It is an incredible story, as you will hear. Lee came in to talk to me about Cherry and his incredible, incredible story of surviving that trauma and the eventual grief after she passed away.
Lockdown has been strange, right?
Strange, yeah.
And there's been some negative things about lockdown and COVID. I've lost a few people during this time.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. My father included.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so it's been crazy in that respect.
Gosh, what a time, what an intense time you've had. So, I mean, that, you know, isn't who we're here to talk about. Lee, who are we specifically remembering today?
So, my mum.
Your mum, yes. Which is Cherry, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. I love that name.
Oh, thank
you. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
It's so nice.
Thank you.
So, some people may know that name already, but would you mind telling us why perhaps that name is known to some people already, Cherry Gross?
So, my mum, Cherry Gross, is more known for being the woman who was shot in front of her children by the police in 1985, which then sparked the 1985 Brixton uprisings. Yeah, so that's probably where people may remember my mum's name from and would associate her to that injustice, essentially, which happened almost 35 years ago now.
It's interesting. It's, you know, obviously, we will talk about this, you know, we are dealing with these situations still, very recently with the Black Lives Matter movement and what happened, the murder of George Floyd. And I certainly was having conversations with people who were saying things like, oh, well, you know, it's not as bad here. And I think it's really important to remember Cherry and 1985 not being that long ago and what was happening here and what is still happening here. I think sometimes we have a bit of a myopic view of our own history of like, oh, well, we're not like that, you know. But yeah, obviously, I think for some people that they won't even know that happened in 1985.
Exactly.
So were you one of those children? Did you see it happen, if you don't mind me asking?
Yes, so I was one of those children. I was 11 at the time.
Oh, Lee.
And I was in the room when my mum got shot. So it was a really horrific and traumatic incident at the time.
Yes. Oh, my goodness me. Do you, and I'm, you know, please say if anything is like... Because sometimes with these things, there's a human want to know information and not always a need. But like, was it a sort of relatively normal situation before the, you know, suddenly the police were in your house? Was it a complete, things are fine, things are suddenly not fine?
Absolutely. I had just turned 11. I'd started secondary school. It was like my maybe second week in secondary school. So I was just trying to settle in to that new environment. On the weekend, I would normally be on my BMX bike in the sort of, they used to have this kind of skateboard bowlers park around the back of where we lived and a youth centre. So I'd spend most of my evenings and weekends around there mixing with other children in the area. And although we didn't have much, the area which we lived in had a real community spirit. Everybody looked out for each other. And we played out in the streets. My door was never locked, so we felt safe. And then, you know, this incident happened, which just flipped it on its head and turned my life around, and it was never the same ever again.
11 is a really, oh my God, there's no good age to see that. But 11, like you said, you're such on the cusp of growing up, and I imagine it must have made you grow up very quickly, very suddenly, to go from like, yeah, me and my BMX, that's what I'm worrying about, like, what am I going to do this weekend, to suddenly seeing that. I just, oh, Lee, the trauma that you must have gone through, that all of you must have gone through.
I went from being, you know, a child who would had very childlike thoughts, you could say. I actually wanted to be a police officer when I was young. And I was into all the cop programs, Starsky and Hutch, Fun was Chips and Kojak and Cadney and Lacey, all those old cop programs. I used to really love those programs and would role play all the time in my house. So I went from being this kid who was like, yeah, you know, I want to get the bad guy, you know, and to seeing the people who, in your eyes, were the good guys, come in your house and do something terrible, you know, to your mum in front of you. And I think the incident was bad enough witnessing, but it was in the immediate aftermath, there was no empathy or sympathy for what had just happened. You know, I was screaming and shouting at the time, hysterically. And the police officer who shot my mum said, someone better shut this fucking kid up, basically, you know, like, as if to say my screaming was annoying him, you know. And it was in that moment that I realized that this was just so wrong. It wasn't just an accident, this was something that, you know, you do, as I said, there was no sense of remorse, no sense of, okay, this is an innocent woman, this is children. There was no sense of that at the time, and that was hurtful. That was almost like putting salt on the wound, basically.
It's almost incomprehensible sometimes when you really, because I think we're so used to situations being like, oh right, yes, that's awful. But when you really properly humanize a situation and you're like 11-year-old Lee and a policeman saying that to you, it's like, what? Why? what is, like, I don't have the words, because I just think, why wasn't the reaction, oh my God, what have we done? Like, oh God, this is awful, this child. And it's interesting, like you said, that your screaming wasn't seen as, I'm screaming for my mum. It was seen as like, oh God, like, well, this is loud. how can we think? It's like, it's just, it's disgusting, I guess is the only word, isn't it? It's absolutely disgusting. So she was shot in front of you. I'm assuming, you know, suddenly ambulances are involved. And how what happened to you in that interim of the chaos of you, and you know, 11-year-old in that situation?
So just to explain to you a little bit about what happened on the day. So we'd fallen asleep in my mum's room. I was in there. My dad was in the room, and my sister Sharon was in the room. And my mum had got, well, there was a noise, and my mum had got up, and I saw her walking towards the door. So initially, whatever that was, I was still kind of half asleep, and I saw her walking towards the door. I thought, okay, mum's taking care of it, laid back down. And then I heard another loud bang, and I jumped up this time. And I saw my mum just laying on the floor, bleeding, basically. And this man standing over her, shouting at her. And then, you know, once I started to scream hysterically at this officer, whose name is Douglas Lovelock, he then in turn said what I told you he said about telling me to effing shut up. Then my dad looked at me with fear in his eyes. And at that time, my dad used to be in the army, so I thought, if he's scared in this moment, then this must be serious. And that was the only time that the reality kicked in for me, and then I started to feel the fear of what was happening. So they rushed us out of the room, into the living room, and there was about 30 officers in the house, and dogs,
oh my God,
and guns. And I just felt like it was a bad nightmare. You know, I was just thinking, I need to wake up from this bad dream. And it was confusing. They had two female officers who were trying to console us at the time, which was difficult because one breath you needed that, and then, and then another, this was coming from the same people who you just seen shoot your mum.
Yeah, you can't trust them, right? Can you? You can't be like, oh, you're a safe lady who's going to make me feel better. You're like, no, you're on that team. Like,
exactly.
I can't completely relax, can I? Yeah. Right.
And immediately after the ambulance came, they took my mum, and my dad went into a police car behind her because they wouldn't let him into the ambulance. So therefore, we were just left in the house.
Oh my God.
On our own, basically, with the police. That was crazy.
I hate the phrase I can't imagine, but I can't imagine, because it's just the fear that you must have felt. Like, you're, like you said, that's proper nightmare. That's horror film. That's like just awful. And I know you talked about in your book, there was a moment where they told you she had died. Did that come from the police officers then, or was that?
It was on the news, basically.
Oh my God.
Because the only updates we were getting was from the news. So none of the police officers in the house, we just kept asking, you know, what's happening? How's my mum? And nobody could give us any answers. So we just had the TV on in the living room, which was where we was getting updates from. And they'd announced that my mum had died, which was the thing that sparked the uprisings. I mean, it's famously known as the riots, but I prefer to refer to it as an uprising.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And I noticed you doing that, and I think, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Like, my brain was like, oh, the Brixton riots. No, because it is an uprising. Yeah. You're right. I think that there's a lot of conversation about that now, obviously, and if you haven't seen it, there's lots of stuff on social media about changing the language of, you know, rioters and rioting, because you're not rioting if something awful has happened. You are, there is racism, there is oppression, and you are talking about that. And I think the language we use is really important. So, yeah, but it's so funny, isn't it, that in my head I had to go, oh, is that something I didn't know about? I was like, oh, the Brixton, because we just use that phrase, don't we? And when you do use that phrase, it doesn't have any of the nuances of Cherry at the heart of it. You just have this, oh yeah, some people went and ran around and shouting, you know, who were not white. That's what that implies, that phrase, isn't it? It's awful.
And you're right, he hit on the head, and I think especially at that time, you know, the media was really biased. So the narrative of the story was really told through their eyes and not through the eyes of the people who were subjected to the whatever you want to call it, racism, police brutality, oppression. So for us, that's why it's so important to even tell the story, to even write a book, so that finally you get to tell the story from your narrative and people get to hear it from a really human and first-hand experience. So, you know, there's layers. So when they say rioting, don't get me wrong, there was aspects of that. But when you think about what was the trigger, these were people who were concerned and who were brave enough to stand up and say, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. You know, we demand answers. We want to know what happened. We want to know why the police came into this woman's house and shot her in front of her four children.
And I think if you have any doubt, it is worth looking at the paper coverage of the time. It's shocking. It's really shocking. And again, I think it's so easy to be like, oh, you know, things have changed. And obviously, things have changed, but it wasn't that long ago. And I remember looking at some newspaper coverage and I couldn't believe what I was reading, because to me, I was like, God, this is so overtly racist. It's not even like, there's not even like, you know, that kind of, when you can sort of hear the tone and you're like, oh, I think I know what they're saying. I am living this culture enough to read the subtext. But yeah, the papers at that time were extremely, it was clear the racism, wasn't it? It wasn't even hiding it. So you found out, well, to be clear, your mum hadn't died at this point, at this juncture, but you hear this on the news. Were you with your brothers and sisters at the time when you heard that?
So after my mum and my dad had left, it was myself, who was 11, my sister, Lisa, she was 8, my sister Sharon, who was 13, my eldest sister Julia, who was 21 and 6 months pregnant, and my mum's two children, who my mum was babysitting from the night before, who was 7 and age 2, a 2-year-old.
Oh my God.
So all of us was left in the house. Now, when that came over the news, I ran into the kitchen and tried to get a knife to try and slip my wrist, because no. I thought to myself, my mum was my world at that point. And still is. And I felt like if she weren't here, I didn't want to be here, right? And you know, luckily, one of the female police officers grabbed a knife off of me. And then we heard another announcement on saying that she didn't die. So, yeah, it was crazy.
I mean, like, as ever, I'm like covering my face and just like, how? At 11, trying to process, even processing a shooting in your, what is, you know, a home for an 11-year-old is normally safe, normal, boring, like that domestic world. To even process people in your house, people with guns in your house, people who've shot your mum, and then hearing that news and then, oh no, she's not. Like, I can imagine thinking, well, I don't trust it, right? Because you still haven't seen her. I would still be like, don't believe anyone. Like, they have all proved to you that nothing is real, nothing is safe, everything you thought is gone. Like, that must have just been terrifying.
It was, and it took a couple of days before we could actually physically see my mum. So, you know, that those moments leading up to that was, we couldn't sleep. I mean, I remember nights my siblings and I would just be sobbing in a melody. And like, as soon as one person starts, the rest start, and then it stops, and then it starts again. And through the whole night, there was just this kind of melody of sobbing through the night. So, yeah, and we couldn't communicate at the time, really. We couldn't speak about what we had seen or what had happened, you know, all we could do is we all knew how we felt.
Yeah,
and that's what kind of kept us kind of together and united in a sense. But yeah, it was crazy.
But you don't have the vocabulary as a child. I mean, so my dad died when I was 15 of, you know, cancer. It was traumatic and sad, but obviously completely not in the trauma levels that you're dealing with, someone coming into your house in that way. And yeah. And I think I felt for a long time like I would go for the words, and they just, you just don't have them, do you? Because the feelings are so big. She's like, God, this is such a big feeling. I don't even, because it is anger, sadness, fear, like so many things at once. You, as a child, you're like, oh, I don't even know how to pick one out. But for what you went through, how could any of you, even your, you know, you said Juliet was like 20, 21, like, she would have even had the vocabulary at that point to vocalise, oh, I'm really shocked. I don't know, I feel like, because also, yeah, all of you must have just been complete shock, just, and which shock takes such a long time. That's the other thing I think you don't realise till you get older. Like, shock takes weeks, months, years for your body to kind of go, sorry, what just happened?
Absolutely. And you mentioned my sister at 21, and as I said, she was 6 months pregnant. So her main concern was, you know, she's got a baby inside her.
Mm.
And that incident could have made her lose that baby, basically. So I suppose in a sense we were all just kind of dealing with our own feelings. And it wasn't 2 years later when my mum passed that I actually did an exercise with my sisters and said, I need you to write down how you felt you were affected by that incident. And that was the first time I actually understood what happened to them or how they saw things, because we saw things differently. From a different angle, also how that then manifests itself in terms of that trauma and the impact was different. And for the first time, I was able to have an insight into their world, and it was sad. It was sad that I never knew this before, and it was sad that these things happened and they never had the opportunity to communicate. What happened, and the same for them, they never knew what I'd gone through in terms of how I felt and how that then, how it manifested itself and impacted on my life. So it was quite crazy to go through that process.
Yeah, and of course I completely understand it. It, you know, I think any grief, any young grief takes years and years and years. And from what I've read, and I'm talking obviously about much more usual circumstances of a grief or a shock, that when it happens sort of like, you know, for 10 to 20, that kind of teenage bracket, you don't really process it till you get to kind of plus 30, because you're just in shock. And then you spend your 20s kind of going like, hang on a minute, what, you sort of, you're a bit more aware of it. And then by 30 you're like, I need to deal with this. I think all the problems come from that. But it, I think for so long you just can't quite look at something because it's, your brain is still like, it's still protecting you.
And I experienced that, you know, that when you said that, I went through that process. So in my late 20s, coming up to just before I was 30, I hit a brick wall, and I said there was some cycles I was going around in, especially in relationships. And I thought, I need to challenge this. I need to, you know. So my neighbour at the time was a counsellor, and she said she couldn't, you know, she couldn't give me therapy because we're neighbours, but she could introduce me to somebody, and which she did, and I went to see this person. I spent a year with them, but probably by the second session, I was able to join those dots, which I never, up until that point, I thought that whatever I was going through as an adult was an isolated situation. But it was then that I realized that those, you know, that childhood trauma was creating these adult scars that I'm living with. So I was then at that point saying to myself, okay, now I understand how that incident back then is still affecting me today. So it helped me to understand myself a lot more and understand and to be able to detach what was, you know, what is the nature part of me and what is the nurture part of me, which is creating some of these cycles and some of these issues in my life.
Yeah, and I think that phrase is really nice, join the dots, because I think I can relate to that, where you're like, oh no, this is nothing to do with that. It's nothing to do with what happened to me there. Like, I'm just doing this now. And then slowly you step back and you're like, oh my God, of course. Like, something as traumatic as what you and your siblings went through, like, of course it's going to affect you for the rest of your life. But I think you spend a long time as a teenager and a 20-year-old being like, no, it won't affect me, it won't define me, like, it's just a thing that happened. Anyone older is like, what? Of course, like, how can it not? Like, so obviously, as you said, your mum didn't die at that point, but she was obviously very, very seriously injured.
So as a result of my mum being shot by the police, she was now paralysed because the bullet had lodged in her spine, and she became a paraplegic, paralyzed from the waist down. That had a huge impact on us. You know, this was in the 80s. There weren't this kind of the disability awareness that we have today.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really the kind of support and access that we see today back in those days. So we just had to kind of like trial and error, you know, just learn as we go along. And I remember going to see my mum in hospital and the doctor saying, you know, your mum's never going to walk again. Those words, you know, I found it hard to accept. But in that moment, I knew that, okay, Lee, you got to man up now. You know, you can't no longer rely on your mum in the way that you used to. You've now got to be there for her. And so therefore, you know, I took that job really seriously. Mum went to Stoke Mandeville to be rehabilitated, and then she came back to St. Thomas's, and I'd spend as much time with her as possible. Sometimes if I had a day off at school, I'd go to the hospital, go physio with her. I'd even put myself in the wheelchair, and just to have a sense of what it was like for her. So that it was very challenging, and I always speak about what happened to my mum as a slow death. I think from that incident happened, you know, there was a process taking place where she was slowly dying. It was over a 26-year period. So to see someone deteriorate like that and to see their independence taken away, and my mum was a really high-spirited person. She loved music. She loved to dance. You know, she liked to go out. And so to see her life get cut short in that way, and how that affected her as well and her mental well-being was sad to see.
And you know, you say like this man up, which I understand, but you're still 11, aren't you? Like, at that point, it's like that is, it sounds like you did an amazing job of stepping up and being a son and being like, I'm going to be a brilliant child for you. But to have that on your shoulders, 11, that weight must have been so hard. Like, I'm just picturing sort of like 11-year-old Lee. Like, it's just, there's a picture on your book, isn't it? And you just look like the sweetest little boy, big grin, like school picture. Like, what a weight to have to carry from that point. I'm just wondering, I mean, this is probably a stupid question. Like, did they offer you anything or your mum any form of counselling at the time? I mean, I know it's the 80s as well, where like that, it wasn't as much in the conversation. Did anyone say, this is very traumatic, you're going to need some help to deal with this? Or was it more like, oh, she needs physical rehabilitation and that's probably it?
Just physical rehabilitation, yeah. That was it. I went back to school 2 weeks later and no teacher, no adult ever asked me any questions about what happened. No one said, how are you? Do you want to talk about it?
My God.
Nothing at all. And a few years ago, I had the privilege of meeting up with my form tutor, and I asked him about the situation. And I said to him, I thought no one knew because no one ever mentioned it to me. And he says, Lee, everyone knew. It was like when you came back to school, it was like you had a sign on your forehead. And he said, there were teachers who said, I don't want that, had never met you, but said, I don't want that boy in my class because he's going to be a problem. So
a problem,
basically.
So but why, like, what? That is just, it's really, obviously there's a lot of stuff at the moment, and all of us, white people are having to face a lot of horrible, horrible truths. But to me, that's like the racism in that, that you were seen immediately as a problem and not as, that's a kid who's lost it, like his mom, what he's been through. That is just, that's, oh, I don't know. What can, it's just, it's not right. It's not right. I don't know what else to say.
Right. So as you say, it's sad that that was the view. And then there was, he said, then there was other teachers who had a hands-off approach with you, who just said they're going to let you do whatever you want to do, kind of thing. And I had a sense of that when I was at school, where there were things that would happen, and I thought they weren't being dealt with in the way that you expect them to be dealt with, and you're wondering why. And as I said, going back to what we said earlier about how the story was depicted, so therefore you may have had people at that time who do just only read the newspaper and see the news, and that's their view of it, is that your family created the problem. It's because of you why there was riots and Brixton got burnt down and this, that and the other. They're not looking at it as you are victims of this, because that's the way the story's been told.
And also it's so, context obviously is so massively important, because you know, I think mental health in 1985 wasn't a thing, but still even with that kind of kindness, I mean, obviously what happened to you was so, I guess it was so unique, it was such a unique situation that you were the family. I can see that people just don't know, they don't like, you're talking about this vocabulary, people just don't have, the teachers don't have any vocabulary. But it's, I find it sad, and maybe this is my white privilege talking, I find it sad that nobody just like gave you a squeeze or was just like, that's awful, if you ever want to be, because I definitely had teachers try, they sort of, it was always a bit awkward but they would sort of be, well, if you want to talk, you know, you could. And I was thinking, I don't want to talk to you, this is awful. But I think the ignoring is a very, I don't think it happens quite as much now, but I definitely think it was the approach at that time, wasn't it? Like, just ignore it. He doesn't need to deal with it at school. Something awful's happened and school is not the place it's discussed. Whereas actually, of course,
basically,
you're going to get support.
Was their attitude. And there should have been some intervention, because at that time there would have been something that could have been done. So I just think they didn't necessarily feel it was important enough to engage with. No one was willing to really go out of their way. And it was only really that same form tutor that I mentioned, who was the only one who, he still didn't ask me about it, but he was the only one that I felt showed some compassion, and he was someone who did go out of his way. He was the only teacher that ever went to my house and spoke to my mum about what was going on for me at school. Because mum couldn't come to the school, so therefore,
you know,
parents' evenings and all those things, she could never attend. So he was the only one that showed that kind of compassion. Outside of that, no one, you know, you just felt like you were just totally ignored, basically.
I think you're a bit of a miracle, Lee. I think you're a bit of a miracle that you're sat there now, smiling and happy and have written a book. Like, I think there's plenty of people that would have just gone, the world doesn't care. The world doesn't care about me. How can I rectify this in my heart and my soul right now? And I can really, you know, you just want to find good, aren't you? Like, I'm so glad that form tutor, like you said, the way of expressing compassion in 1985 was to visit your house rather than speak to you. It was like, I'll visit the house and speak to his mother. But that in itself is a kindness. There is a, you can see that kind of where that thinking comes from. Thank God somebody did even that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. So, you said your mum was paralysed. You're all dealing with this incredible, incredible trauma, but obviously life just ticks along. When did the Cherry Gross Foundation sort of become your project, or when did that happen? Was that quite soon, or did it wait until you were much older for you to think, I'm going to try and make something positive come out of this?
Well, two things happened. When the officer was acquitted from the court proceedings for shooting my mum, there was a sense of like real injustice. Like, and I said to my mum, how do you feel about this? Because I was really upset. And she said, Lee, the police is a force and we can't fight the force, or we can't be the force, she said. And there was this kind of sense of acceptance. And I felt like she...
When was he acquitted? Was that quite soon after the...
2 years after, so that was in 1987. So I felt like she did that because that was her way of coping with the situation. But for me, it didn't sit well with me, and it was something that I felt I didn't accept, and it was something that I felt like I wanted to do something about one day. How that was going to manifest, I didn't have a clue, but I just knew in my heart that it was something that I was never going to accept. And then I used to see around Black History Month, there'll be all these stories that they talk about that go back as far as the 81 uprisings in Brixton. And then I would think they would skip over like what my mum's incident, and I'd be like, how is it that there's no real detail information about what happened to my mum, and there's no kind of personal account of that story? So there was a burning desire from a teen to write that, basically. And then it wasn't until my mum passed in 2011, ironically it was the same year that we had the uprisings around Mark Duggan.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, that's where all the hurt, the pain, grief, everything, trauma that we'd gone through just came flooding back when my mum passed. Because I think we learned to cope and suppress that, and because mum dealt with it in a certain way, we followed suit. So in that moment, I felt like her life and what she went through has to stand for something. And there was no way that I was going to just allow her to just, you know, to be forgotten in that way. So that's where the drive and determination came from, to say, okay, how do I keep her memory alive? How do I make sure her legacy lives on? How do I make sure that what happened to her stands for something, and that people can take something and learn something from this? You know, what's the different ways vehicles I can use to do this? And that's one of them was the foundation. I thought, okay, if we set this foundation up, primarily, when we set up the foundation, it was to look at how we support people with disabilities. Because I felt like, you know, all my life I've been a carer. I know this inside out through, you know, first-hand experience. So therefore, maybe all the things that I, you know, took me so many years to know and learn and understand, how now could I help somebody else understand that earlier? How could I help people to become more active, more independent, benefit from the fact that London has become more accessible? Yes, they could be doing more, but there's a lot that people can do now. But there's people who are still kind of trapped at home, believing in their head that they can't engage with society now, that they've kind of given up. How can we give those people some hope? So that's where that setting up the foundation came from. And then when we had the glimmer of the inquest into my mum's death, which would allow us to reinvestigate and re-explore what had happened to her, all that hurt, anger, pain, and grief that I was feeling, I put all that energy into that process. And I said to myself, I'm just going to throw myself into this and just hope for the best. And thankfully, we got the right result, that, you know, what happened to my mum was wrong. It was a failure on by the Metropolitan Police. And we finally got an apology to engage with those failures. Unfortunately, the person who most needed to hear that, who's my mum, was no longer here. But it was the greatest gift that I could give her in her absence, basically.
It's such a bittersweet thing, isn't it? It's like, oh, I'm so glad they apologise. Years later, you're like, it's like part of you that's like, oh, good, not good enough. It's the bare minimum. It's the bare minimum. It's just, I think that's incredible that you were able to channel that. And to have, I think also what you said, I completely understand that there's this sort of, because your mum, you know, like you said, she did live for so long, and they set the tone. They set the tone of like, this is how we're going to deal with this. So of course, you and your siblings have to go, okay, well, you know, she wants to lead this path of right acceptance, and we get on with it because she wants to just live her life. You have to sort of park it, don't you? Park all these feelings. And like you said, then 2011, when she does pass, this box is there of like, oh, there's all those feelings. What do I do with them? So when she passed, was it due to the complications, or was it just like you said, this, were you with her when she passed away?
So she passed on Easter Sunday. Oh. And mum spent a lot of time in hospital, so she'd be in and out of hospital to the point where it was normal for us. So we wouldn't even tell anybody that she was in hospital anymore. So she's in hospital, and we're thinking she's going to go in, spend maybe a week or two, and be back at home as usual. But this time she took a turn for the worse. So my younger sister Lisa, we would normally go to the hospital every day, right? And what had happened on this particular day, my niece was christening her daughter that day. So we said, okay, we're not going to go to the hospital today. So we're just going to call in and say, just check on mum, and we'll go and see her the following day. So we called in, and the nurse says, okay, that's fine, you can come tomorrow, mum's stable. However, the doctor did want to speak to you, but I'm sure it could wait till tomorrow. So I thought, I don't like the sound of that. So I said, let's just go up there for half an hour, see the doctor, and then we'll go to the blessing. So got there, and we was in the room with the doctor, and he started speaking. And from when he started to speak, the first few lines, I knew what he was trying to say to me. And he basically said, you know, I've read your mum's files, I've seen what she's gone through, and you know, her organs are failing. And what do you think your mum would want right now? And basically putting that question to me about, you know, whether or not we should basically allow her to just pass. Or would she want us to do everything in our power to fight, even if it means she'll be like on dialysis for the rest of her life?
Yeah.
And it was a horrible position to be in, because you're saying to yourself, okay, you're trying to choose between what you would want and what you think your mum would want, and they're different, because 2 weeks before I knew what the answer was, because 2 weeks before I left, I was in the hospital, and just before I was leaving, mum just looked out through the window and she said, Lee, I just want to be free. And I've never heard her say that before. You know, she was a fighter. She was, you know, I never heard her speak in a way of like giving up. So when I heard that, it was like it didn't register at first. And I was walking down the hospital corridor thinking, did she really just say that? I've never heard her say that before. So when the doctor asked me that question, I really instinctively I knew the answer.
She'd already told you.
She already told me. Yeah. So I grappled with it for a little while, called all the family, and you know, ultimately they just looked at me and said, "Lee, we think you should, you and Lisa should make the decision, because we were the main carers." And then Lisa said, "I'm not making it, you need to make it." Then,
thanks, guys.
Exactly. So I prayed about
it. Oh, cheers.
Exactly. So I prayed about it, and then, yeah, we made the decision to just allow her to slip away naturally that day. Mm. And we were all there at her bedside. Yeah, it was, it's a feeling that it's hard to even describe, but I was just so present in that moment.
Mm.
And in my words to my mum was something along the lines of, "I want to do everything that I can to make sure that, you know, what you've been through is recognized." And I didn't know how. I had no clue that there was going to be an inquest. I had no clue about, you know, coming up with this idea of a foundation or a memorial or even this book. It was just that a raw desire to do something to make sure that she this wasn't in vain.
I'm in danger of always looking for good, but I think it's really amazing that she said that to you and you heard it, because I hear so many stories where it didn't get heard or it didn't get said. And I had a friend pass away recently who was a palliative care nurse, and she was an amazing, amazing woman. And I talk about her a lot on the show because she was so brilliant. And she was a real advocate of advanced care planning. When I first met her, I was like, you know, what is that? And she was like, anybody can tell anyone. You can make a plan for what, you know, so that you don't get hooked up to machines for the rest of your life. And because obviously she spent a lot of time looking after people who were like totally being kept alive by a machine, rather than, because they hadn't had that conversation. And she was a real advocate of like, have these chats. I know it's so hard. And you know, then very sadly something happened to her, and they were able to put in her plan, which was, don't try and keep me alive, I don't want to. And it's a really painful thing. And I think, God, especially for you, after having cared for her for so long and helped her fight and kept her going, for her then to say, you know, I'm ready now, like, it's okay. And for that, for you to hear that, like, I think just, you know, credit to her for raising a good son, and credit to you for being a good son, like, that you were brave enough to hear it, brave enough to go, yeah, she's ready, that's okay, we've, you know. Because I think especially when you, like you said, that fight and drive to survive that you must have all had to have to cope with a situation which people weren't talking about, was not being reported properly, all of the things that should have happened hadn't have happened. So to like, yeah, it's funny though, isn't it? Because I guess it, perhaps you at that point thought, oh, this is the end of the journey, but it wasn't, because like you said, then you were then able to then, right, I can now do all these things. And you mentioned it there is a memorial to Cherry, and it's coming in September, that's right, isn't it? It's,
yeah,
it will be revealed.
The aim was that it was supposed to be erected at, on the 28th of September, which would have been the 35th anniversary of when the shooting happened.
Right.
It may be slightly delayed, and it's probably going to be October now. But yeah, I think, how can I put it, at the time, and I've done everything in the same vein. So everything I've done has been with mum at the forefront. Okay, what would mum want? You know, what was she like? And I've always tried to incorporate that into everything that I do. And so far, it hasn't failed me in that respect. And as I said, when we was in the hospital and the question was asked, that was the first time that I was in, you know, in direct conflict about what would want and what I would want. Because, you know, selfishly, you know, you want to do everything to keep the person that you love the most to be here, right? You're going to want to do everything you can. But to think about that person and put them first and think, what would that person really want? And the way that the doctor phrased it as well, you know, to say, what do you think your mum would want? As I said, I really knew the answer to that question. So therefore, it was just about doing the right thing and making sure that I put her first rather than mine or our feelings first, in a sense of just doing whatever we could to save her. And even though life was going to be more difficult than what it was, and it was tough already for her. You know, she was in constant pain because the fragment was some of the fragments were still in her spine, so that caused her constant pain. She was getting bed sores. She was getting she had diabetes now. She was going to the hospital more regularly. She was getting infections, and all this was as a result of that incident, as a result of that shooting. Her conditions were just getting worse and worse.
It's just such a lot. The incident itself is such a lot. And I think also it's really important. I'm so grateful for you for speaking about it, for writing about it, because again, to remind people that it's not just a shooting. Because you know what I mean? You could have that, oh yeah, there was a shooting, there was an uprising, and then there wasn't anymore. La la la. Like, it's like she had fragments left in her body, like literally the aftershocks of that event carried on and on and on and on and on, and will carry on and have affected you and all of that, which is why the irony of being a sort of, you know, 20 something and thinking like, oh, I'm not affected by this, it's just something that happened, is like, how can you not be? How could she not be? How could you all not be affected by physically, mentally, spiritually, all of that stuff? It's just, and I, you know, I've been reading a lot lately about complicated grief. Yeah, I'm just wondering about your grief and how your grieving process, because it wasn't, yeah, like you said, suddenly all that stuff that had happened, why she had these problems, must have then, like, and the trauma of the 11-year-old Lee must have suddenly been very, very visceral to you after she had gone.
Yes. So what had happened, what happens is, in a process like this, and probably a lot of people can relate to this who've had a loved one pass, is that you get into this autopilot mode where you're just doing, you're organising a funeral, and that keeps you busy. And then we had the funeral, and then I remember going back to the cemetery the day after the funeral, and the cemetery was locked, and I jumped over the fence, the gate, and went to my mum's grave, and it was just me in the cemetery, and I was able to just express myself. And I remember just having this outburst. It was almost like a rage or a rant, and just how I felt. And I almost felt like that 11-year-old kid again.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, what was coming up for me. And I was so angry and hurt about what had happened to her. So it wasn't the loss necessarily. It wasn't just about the fact that I've lost my mum. It was the fact that of what she went through, the life that she had to live, how she suffered. So all of that for me, what I've learned to suppress, just came up. Mm. And in that moment, I was basically making a commitment to her, and I was praying that there was, because there was this glimmer of the inquest at that time, and I was just praying that this glimmer manifests into something that I can really pour all of this energy into, because if not, I didn't know where it was going to go.
Yeah,
I had no clue
of
where all this anger was going to go, and all this, you know, this kind of grief that I was feeling. So because it did lead somewhere, I had something to channel my energy into.
Mm.
And that's going through that whole cycle and getting the results that we got in the end has helped me with my process. Mm. It's helped me to find some peace within myself. In terms of what we've gone through, what we've witnessed, there's that big still sense of loss, where she was such a big part of our life, and we will never forget her in that respect. But at least now, when my siblings and I gather, we can smile, we can laugh, we can remember some of the good things, you know, about Mum, and some of the fun that we had and the laughs that we used to have. Because it wasn't, we used laughter to cope. It wasn't like every day was just like a hard, challenging day for us where we just, you know, everybody was sad. No, there was times when, you know, we would have to raise our spirits somehow through cracking a joke or creating a vibe or atmosphere in the house and playing music and bringing the party to, you know, we couldn't bring mum to the party, so we brought the party to mum. So you know, we had to deal with it in all those different ways.
So I think that must have been so important. And so she passed in 2011. When did you have the final inquest? What year was that? How many years did you have sort of?
So the inquest happened in 2014. So it was a long journey. And
a long journey.
You know, it started, the first obstacle we had was getting legal aid to be active in that inquest. So we got denied 3 times and we ended up doing a petition and in the end getting over 130,000 people to sign that petition. Went to 10 Downing Street, presented that petition, and then a week later they overturned the decision and we got access to legal support. So at every step of the way, there was a challenge, basically, right? The amount of hoops we had to jump over, the amount of time that went past, and they already knew that as well, because there was this report that highlighted their failures anyway, which was done by a really senior officer. So therefore, it was always there. It wasn't like we discovered some new evidence.
Right,
it was
some magical key. It was like, oh, that is a video of it. Oh, right. It's like, of course they aren't. Everybody knew, right? There's right. just this weird sense of trying to avoid saying I was wrong, which that's what's sad, isn't it? It's like,
right.
you just start from a position of like, obviously we're wrong. How do we make it better? Rather than like, well, we're going to give you, we were 10% wrong. But we're not going to give you 100% because like, actually, no, like, you know what I mean? It's like arguing about things.
And it's the same system that says to you, that tries to encourage you, us, the people, that number one, don't do wrong. And if you are, if you do wrong, put your hands up. Because if you put your hands up, we're going to be more lenient, right? But you don't do that when you're wrong, right? And they've got this kind of way around sort of damage limitation where, you know, they don't want people to see that they do things wrong. Because they seem, then they think that the people, they'll be undermined or, you know, people would lose confidence. But it's the other way around. The more you're able to say, all right, we effed up, we got it wrong, we apologise, and we're prepared to learn from that and put things in place to make sure it doesn't happen again, is the more we have confidence in you.
Again, testament to you and your family and Cherry that you had that spirit to keep fighting, that you didn't give up, that you carried on, because it would have been very easy just to walk away when no one is listening correctly. How can you know? That's where madness lies, just keeping saying the same thing and someone going, you're wrong, it didn't happen. Like, that is a form of gaslighting, control. Like, how do you cope with that? I completely understand going, well, we're just gonna keep our heads down and carry on then, because what we're hearing is not what happened.
Exactly, and there are a lot of people who do give up, and it's, you can understand why. Because let's just say, for instance, I went through all of that, and we were talking today, and I had no results. I don't know how I'd feel. I don't even know if I'd be able to communicate in the way that I'm communicating today about it. So there is a risk that you could, you know, there could be a further injustice, that you could further damage. You know, there could be. In terms of what you've gone through, now on top of it, you've done everything you can to get the acknowledgement for what's happened, and you still don't get it. And there's people in that position today. So we're like one of the very few examples that you could use where you've had this kind of enlightening, and where we can speak from a place of strength now and say, okay, this happened, it was wrong, everyone knows it was wrong now. The police have apologised, and now we've actually got some restorative justice outcomes to help us to ensure that this doesn't happen again, that lessons can be learned, and we can have a better society moving forward. So for example, I've got my youngest is 8, and when she sees the police, she gets scared, right? And that's because she knows, she's aware of the story, right? I was walking with her the other day up in the West End, And a police officer just said, oh, hello. You know, he was a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And she just clammed up and wouldn't even respond. And I said to her, why didn't you say hello? And she said, Dad, I'm scared of the police. And I've got to try and balance that somewhat.
Yeah.
I don't want her to be constantly scared of the police. I want her to know that she could call on them when she needs them because they are there to serve. However, she has got a personal story that does conflict that image of the nice Bobby on the street. So the only way we can deal with that is to make sure that now we got stories to tell of how things have changed. Okay, that terrible thing happened to your grandmother, but as a result of that, now this is in place, that's in place, and this is, you know, there's better policing because of X, Y, Z. I want to be able to tell them those stories to give them confidence and to give others as well.
Yeah, and I think what you said, I think you said it right at the beginning, is so important, that the all narratives are heard, because I think that is like, and the more I do this show, the more I'm like, humans need stories. That's how we understand everything. Like, if we don't have a story, we don't understand it. And like, you can, you know, there's thousands of examples of this. And the story that was told about Cherry in that situation, it was so important that your narrative, the inquest, changed that. And now this book, The Louder I Will Sing, will change that. And that's enabling, like you said, your children to hear this other side and to know the foundation is changing, that, you know, you have put, people are aware, they admit they're wrong, so it won't happen. Hopefully it won't happen again. Obviously, as you said, there are lots of people still fighting for their cases. And, you know, obviously there's a case in America very similar, the Breonna Taylor case. Those narratives are so important, that we have that story, that we have your story, that you did get that inquest. And they did say, they did admit the truth. They'd done something wrong. But it's I really feel for you as a parent in that situation, because you don't want your daughter to be, you know, you want her to know, yeah, call, something happens, call 999, like that's what you need, like, you should feel that. But also, yeah, of course, you don't want to deny the truth is what that happened. And I guess all you can do is move forward with positivity where you can, but not deny that it happened, not talk about it, like you said, like what happened at school, like ignoring it doesn't make it, it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Exactly. And, you know, one of my, because as well as fighting for my past, which is my mum, and acknowledging what had happened and what we went through as a family, there's also the fighting for the future.
Yeah.
And I'm determined to make sure that the residue doesn't live on in my children.
Mm.
Then I want them to see the world in a different way. But at the same time, that can only happen if it is different.
Mm, yeah.
You know, I don't want to sell them a dream that, you know, this kind of, you know,
it's
fantasy.
Fixed, yeah.
Yeah. But as you said, we've got to find some balance within that, that they can have some confidence, but also know that police can do, you know, there are some police who shouldn't be police officers and do terrible things. And what we want to see, as I say, is some accountability. We may never get rid of it completely, but if we're dealing with the problem, then that's the next step that I want to see, that these officers are being held accountable for their actions, and that the police as an institution are doing their best to change that culture, because it's been acceptable for too long. You know, we want to see that. We want to see a difference. You know, and really, it's not too much to ask for. And it makes the work society a better place. No one wants to see officers in the police who are abusing their power and who are biased and are not policing fairly and equally. So, that's how I see things.
Yeah, I think you put it really well. It's like, it's, you don't want to sell a dream because it's not true, but you do want to offer a workable reality, I suppose, of like, you know, in any industry, there'll be people who are biased or racist or not nice or will do bad things. In any industry, you know, no one is all good. The important thing here is that the police industry, the police world, when they do bad things, it can have very serious consequences, and therefore the accountability needs to be very, very high and very monitored and very careful, because what we're dealing here isn't with, like, you know, what I deal with, like, oh, that comedian wasn't very funny. Like, it's like, oh, I can't get my money back. Oh, well, it's like we're dealing with death and life here. Lee.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it. It's an extraordinary thing that you've been through, and I just think you've dealt with it incredibly bravely and beautifully, and I don't mean that as a, oh, therefore it was a wonderful thing that happened. It obviously wasn't. I just think the book is called The Louder I Will Sing. It's out on the 17th of September, and hopefully you'll be able to have the memorial ceremony with yes. some people there, and some, you know, whether they're standing 2 meters apart, but it the main thing is it is going to be there in Brixton. That's right, isn't it?
That's right, in Windrush Square, in Brixton, heart of Brixton.
Yeah, a very important place in Brixton. So it's amazing that has happened. Yeah, thank you for talking to me about your journey and Cherry's as well.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm sorry we didn't even get to talk about your dad as well. What was your dad's name?
So my dad's name was Leo.
So Cherry and Leo. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You can follow Lee on Twitter and Instagram at Mr. Lee Lawrence. His book, The Louder I Will Sing, is out on the 17th of September 2020 and is available from all good bookshops. If you would like more information about the Cherry Gross Foundation, please head to www.cherrygross.org, and they have a GoFundMe as well as part of the Cherry Gross Memorial. So if you'd like any more information on the memorial or when the service is happening at Windrush Square, do head to the website. You can follow Griefcast on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland, music by The Glue Ensemble, artwork by Jade Perkin, and remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.